From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. There's a Long, Long Trail of Winding by Russell Kirk. Then he said unto the disciples, It is impossible, but that offenses will come, but woe unto him to whom they come. It were better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck, and he cast into the sea, than that he should offend one of these little ones. From the Gospel of Luke. Along the vast, empty, six-lane highway, the blizzard swept as if it were meant to swallow all the sensual world. Frank Sarsfield, massive though he was, scudded like a heavy kite before that overwhelming wind. On his thick white hair, the snow clotted and tried to form a cap, the big flakes so swirled around his Viking face that he scarcely could make out the barren country on either side of the road. Somehow he must get indoors. Racing for sanctuary, the last automobiles had swept unheeding past his thumb 2 hours ago, bound doubtless for the county town some 20 miles eastward. Westward, among the hills, the highway must be blocked by snowdrifts now. This was an unkind 12th of January. Blow, blow, thou winter wind. Twilight being almost upon him, soon he must find lodging, or else freeze stiff by the roadside. He had walked more than 30 miles that day, having in his pocket the sum of $29.30. He could have put up at either of the two motels he had passed, had they not been closed for the winter. Well, as always, he was decently dressed, a good wash-and-wear suit, and a neat black overcoat. As always, he was shaven and clean and civil-spoken. Surely some farmer or villager would take him in if he knocked with a $10 bill in his fist. People sometimes mistook him for a stranded, well-to-do motorist, and sometimes he took the trouble to undeceive them. But where to apply? This was depopulated country, its forests gone to the sawmills long before its mines worked out. The freeway ran through the abomination of desolation. He did not prefer to walk the freeways, but on such a day as this there were no cars on the lesser roads. He had run away from a hardscrabble New Hampshire farm when he was 14, and ever since then, except for brief working intervals, he had been either on the roads or in the jails. Now his 60th birthday was imminent. There were few men bigger than Frank Sarsfield, and none more solitary. Where was a friendly house? For a few moments the rage of the snow slackened. He stared about. Away to the left, almost a mile distance, he made out a grim, high clump of buildings on rising ground, a wall enclosing them. The roof of the central building was gone. Sarsfield grinned, knowing what the complex must be, a derelict prison. He had lodged in prisons altogether too many nights. His hands sheltering his eyes from the north wind, he looked to his left, down in a snug valley besides a narrow river and broad marshes. He could perceive a village or hamlet, a white church tower, 3 or 4 commercial buildings, some little houses, beyond them a park of bare maple trees. The old highway must have run through or near this forgotten place, but the new freeway had sealed it off. There was no sign of a freeway exit to the settlement. Probably it could be reached by car only along some detouring country lane. In such a little decayed town, there would be folk willing to accept him for the sake of his proffered $10, or, better, simply for charity's sake, and talk with an amusing stranger who could recite every kind of poetry. He scrambled heavily down the embankment. At this point, praise be, no tremendous wire fence kept the haughty new highway inviolable. His powerful thighs took him through the swelling drifts, though his heart pounded as the storm burst upon him afresh. The village was more distant than he had thought. He passed, panting, through old fields half grown up to poplar and birch. A little to the west he noticed what seemed to be old mine workings, with fragments of brick buildings. He clambered upon an old railroad bed, its rails and ties taken up. Perhaps the new freeways had dealt the final blow to the rails. Here the going was somewhat easier. Mingled with the wind's shriek, did he hear a church bell now? Could they be holding services at the village in this weather? Presently he came to a burnt-out little railroad depot. On its platform signboard still the name Anthonyville. Now he walked on a street of sorts, but no car tracks or footprints sullying the snow. Anthonyville Free Methodist Church hulked before him. Indeed, the bell was swinging, and now and again faintly ringing in the steeple, but it was the wind's mockery, a knell for the derelict town of Anthonyville. The church door was slamming in the high wind, flying open again and slamming once more, like a perpetual motion machine. The glass being gone from the church windows, Sarsfield trudged past the skeletal church. The front of Eamon's general store was boarded up, and so was the front of what may have been a drug store. The village hall was a wreck. The school may have stood upon those scanty foundations which protruded from the snow, and from no chimney of the decrepit cottages and cabins along Main Street, the only street, did any smoke rise. Sarsfield never had seen a deader village. In an upper window of what looked like a livery stable, converted into a garage, a faded cardboard sign could be read: "Remember your future, back the Townsend planned." Was no one at all left here, not even some gaunt old couple managing on Social Security? He might force his way into one of the stores or cottages, though on principle and prudence he generally steered clear of possible charges of breaking and entering. But that would be cold comfort. In poor Anthonyville, there must remain some living soul. His mittened hands clutching his red ears, Sarsfield had plodded nearly to the end of Main Street. Anthonyville was Ennsville, he saw now. River and swamp and new highway cut it off altogether from the rest of the frozen world, except for the drift-obliterated country road that twisted southward, Lord knew where. He might count himself lucky to find a stove, left behind in some shack that he could feed with boards ripped from the walls. Main Street ended at that grove or park of old maples, just a sugar bush like those he had tapped in his boyhood under his father's rough command. No, had the trees not been leafless, he might not have discerned the big stone house among the trees, the only substantial building remaining to Anthonyville. But see it he did for one moment, before the blizzard veiled it from him. There were stone gateposts, too, and a bronze tablet set into one of them. Sarsfield brushed the snowflakes from the inscription. Tamarack House. Stumbling among the maples towards the promise, he almost collided with a tall glacial boulder. A similar boulder rose a few feet to his right, the pair of them halfway between gatepost and house. There was a bronze tablet on this boulder, too, and he paused to read it. Sacred to the memory of Jerome Anthony, July 4, 1836 to January 14, 1915. Brigadier General in the Corps of Engineers, Army of the Republic, founder of this town, architect of Anthonyville State Prison, who died as he had lived, with honor. And there I will keep you forever, yes, forever and a day, yes, forever and a day, till the wall shall crumble in ruin and moulder and dust away. There's an epitaph for a prison architect, Sarsfield thought. It was too bitter an evening for inspecting the other boulder, and he hurried towards the portico of Tamarack House. This was a very big house indeed, a bracketed house built all of squared fieldstone with beautiful glints to the masonry. A cupola topped it. Once, come out of the cold into a public library, Sarsfield had pored through a picture book about American architectural styles. There was a word for this sort of house. Was it Italianate? Yes. It rose in his memory. He took pride in no quality except his power of recollection. Yes, that was the word. Had he visited this house before? He could not account for a vague familiarity. Perhaps there had been a photograph of this particular house in that library book. Every window was heavily shuttered, and no smoke rose from any of the several chimneys. Sarsfield went up the stone steps to confront the oaken front door. It was a formidable door, but it seemed as if at some time it had been broken open, for long ago a square of oak with a different grain had been mortised into the area around lock and keyhole. There was a gigantic knocker with a strange face worked upon it. Sarsfield knocked repeatedly. No one answered. Conceivably the storm might have made his pounding inaudible to any occupants, but who could spend the winter in a shuttered house without fires? Another bronze plaque was screwed to the door. Tamarack House, property of the Anthony Family Trust, guarded by Protective Service. Sarsfield doubled the veracity of the last line. He made his way around to the back. No one answered those back doors either, and they too were locked. But presently he found what he had hoped for, an old-fangled, slanting cellar door set into the foundations. It was not wise to enter without permission, but at least he might accomplish it without breaking. His fingers, though clumsy, were strong as the rest of him. After much trouble, and with help from the Boy Scout knife that he carried, he pulled the pins out of the cellar door's three hinges and scrambled down into the darkness. With the passing of the years, he had become something of a jailhouse lawyer, though those young inmates bored him with their endless chatter about Miranda and Escobedo, and now he thought of the doctrine called defense of necessity. If caught, he could say that self-preservation from freezing is the first necessity. Besides, they might not take him for a bum. Faint light down the cellar steps, he would replace the hinge pins later, showed him an inner door at the foot. That door was hooked, though hooked only. With a sigh, Sarsfield put his shoulder to the door. The hook clattered to the stone floor inside, and he was master of all he surveyed. In that black cellar he found no light switch. Though he never smoked, he carried matches for such emergencies. Having lit when he discovered a providential kerosene lamp on a table with enough kerosene still in it, Sarsfield went lamplit through the cellars and up more stone stairs into a pantry. "Anybody home?" he called. It was an eerie echo. How could he make sure before exploring? For he dreaded shotguns. How about a cheerful song? In that chill pantry, Sarsfield bellowed a tune formerly beloved at Rotary clubs. Once a waggish Rotarian, after half an hour's talk with the hobo extraordinary, had taken him to Rotary for lunch and commanded him to tell tales of the road and to sing for members a song. Frank Sarsfield's untutored voice was loud enough when he wanted it to be, and he sang the song he had sung to the Rotary. "There is a long, long trail a-winding into the land of my dreams, where the nightingales are singing and the white moon beams. There's a long, long night of waiting until my dreams all come true, till the day when I'll be going down that long, long trail with you." No response, no cry, no footsteps, not a rustle. Even in so big a house, they couldn't have failed to hear his song, sung in a voice fit to wake the dead. Father O'Malley had called Frank's voice Stenorian, a good word, though he was not just sure what it meant. He liked that last tune, though. He'd no one to walk to. He'd repeat it. "Till the day when I'll be going down that long, long trail with you." It was all right. Sarsfield went into the dining room, where he found a splendid long walnut table, chairs with embroidered seats, a fine sideboard and china cabinet, and a high Venetian chandelier. The china was in that cabinet, and the silverware was in that sideboard. But in no room of Tamarack House was any living soul. Sprawled in a big chair before the fireplace in the Sunday parlor, Sarsfield took the chill out of his bones. The woodshed, connected with the main house by a passage from the kitchen, was half filled with logs, not first-rate fuel, true, for they had been stacked there 3 or 4 years ago, to judge by the fungi upon them, but burnable after he had collected old newspapers and chopped kindling. He had crisscrossed elm and birch to make a noble fire. It was not very risky to let white wood smoke eddy from the chimneys, for it would blend with the driving snow, and the blast would dissipate it at once. Besides, Anthonyville's population was zero. From the cupola atop the house, in another lull of the blizzard, he had looked over the icy countryside and had seen no inhabited farmhouse up the forgotten dirt road, which anyway was hopelessly blocked by drifts today. There was no approach for vehicles from the freeway, while river and marsh protected the rear. He speculated that Tamarack House might be inhabited summers, though not in any recent summers. The protective service probably consisted of a farmer who made a fortnightly inspection in fair weather. It was good to hole up in a remote county where burglars seemed unknown as yet. Frank Sarsfield restricted his own depredations to church poor boxes, Catholic preferably, he being no Protestant, and then only under the defense of necessity, after a run of unsuccessful mendicancy. He feared and detested strong thieves, so numerous nowadays. To avoid them and worse than thieves, he steered clear of the cities, roving to little places which still kept crime in the family, where it belonged. He had dined and then washed the dishes dutifully. The kitchen wood range still functioned, and so did the hard water and soft water hand pumps in the scullery. As for food, there was enough to feed a good-sized prison. The shelves of the deep cellar cold room threatened to collapse under the weight of glass jars full of jams, jellies, preserved peaches, apricots, applesauce, pickled trout, and many, many good things, all redolent of his New England youth. Most of the jars had neat paper labels all giving the year of canning, some the name of the canner. On the front shelves, the most recent date he had found was 1968, on a little pot of strawberry jam, and below it was the name Allegra in a feminine hand. Everything in this house lay in apple pie order, though Sarsfield wondered how long the plaster would keep from cracking with Tamarack House unheated in winter. He felt positively virtuous for lighting fires, one here in the Sunday parlor, another in the little antique iron stove in the bedroom he had chosen for himself at the top of the house. He had poked into every handsome room of Tamarack House with the intense pleasure of a small boy who had found his way into an enchanted castle. Every room was satisfying, well furnished. He was warming by the fire 2 sheets from the linen closets for his bed, and wondrously old-fashioned. There was no electric light, no central heating, no bathroom. There was an indoor privy at the back of the woodshed, but no running water unless one counted the hand pumps. There was an old-fanger wall telephone. Frank tried, greatly daring, for the operator, but it was dead. He had found a crystal-set radio that didn't work. This was an old lady's house, surely, and the old lady hadn't visited for some years. But perhaps her relatives kept it in order as a holiday home, or in hope of selling it at ruined Anthonyville, a forlorn hope. He had discovered 2 canisters of tea, a jar full of coffee beans and 10 gallons of kerosene. How thoughtful. Perhaps the old lady was dead, buried under the other boulder among the maples in front of the house. Perhaps she had been the general's daughter. But no, not if the general had been born in 1836. Why those graves in the lawn? Sarsfield had heard of farm families near medical schools who in the old days had buried their dead by the house for fear of body snatchers. But that couldn't apply at Anthonyville. Well, there were family graveyards, but this must be one of the smallest. The old general who built this house had died on January 14, day after tomorrow. January 14 would come round again, and it would be Frank Sarsfield's 60th birthday. "I drink your health and water, General," Sarsfield said aloud, raising his cut glass goblet taken from the china cabinet. There was no strong drink in the house, but that didn't distress Sarsfield, for he never touched it. His mother had warned him against it, and sure enough, the one time he had drunk a good deal of wine, when he was new to the road, he had got sick. "Thanks, General, for your hospitality." Nobody responded to his toast. His mother had been a saint, the neighbors had said, and his father a drunken devil. He had seen neither of them after he ran away. He missed his mother's funeral because he hadn't known of her death until months after. He had missed his father's long later because he chose to miss it. Though that omission cost him sleepless nights now, Sarsfield slept poorly at best. Almost always there were nightmares. Yet perhaps he would sleep well enough tonight in that little garret room near the cupola. He had found that several of the bedrooms in Tamarack House had little metal plates over their doorways. There was the general's room, and father's room, and mama's room, and Alice's room, and Allegra's room, and Edith's room. By happy coincidence, the little room at the top of the back stair on the garret floor of the house was labeled Frank's room. But he'd not chosen it for that only. At the top of the house, one was safer from the sheriffs or burglars, and through the skylight there was only a frieze window. A man could get to the roof of the main block. From that roof one could descend to the woodshed roof by a fire escape of iron rungs hung in the stone outer wall, and from the woodshed was an easy drop to the ground. After that, the chief difficulty would be to run down Main Street and then get across the freeway without being detected. While people searched the house for you, talk of Goldilocks and the three beasts. Much experience had taught Sarsfield such forethought. Had that other Frank, so commemorated over the bedroom door, been a son or a servant? Presumably a son, though Sarsfield had found no pictures of boys in the old velvet-covered album in the Sunday parlor, nor any of the manservants. There were many pictures of the general, a little rooster-like man with a beard and of father, portly and pleasant-faced, and of mama, elegant, and of the three small girls who must be Alice and Allegra and Edith. He had liked especially the photographs of Allegra, since he had not tasted her strawberry jam. All the girls were pretty, but Allegra, who must have been about 7 in most of the pictures, was really charming, with long ringlets and kind eyes, and a delicate mouth that curved upward at its corners. Sarsfield adored little girls and distrusted big girls. His mother had cautioned him against bad women, so he had kept away from such. Because he liked peace, he had never married. Not that he could have married anyway, because that would have tied him to one place, and he was too clumsy to earn money at practically anything except dishwashing for summer hotels. Not marrying had meant that he could have no little daughters like Allegra. Sometimes he had puzzled the prison psychiatrist. In prison it was well to play stupid. He had refrained cunningly from reciting poetry to the psychiatrist. So after testing Sarsfield, they wrote him down as dull normal, and he was assigned to labor as a gardener, which meant going round the prison yards picking up trash with a stick, the nail in the end of it. That was easy work, and he detested hard work. Yet, when there was truly heavy work to be done in prison, sometimes he would come forward to shovel tons of coal or carry brick or lift big blocks into place. That, too, was his cunning. It impressed the other jailbirds with his enormous strength, so that the gangs left him alone. "Yes, you're a loner, Frank Sarsfield," he said to himself aloud. He looked at himself in that splendid Sunday parlor mirror which stretched from floor to ceiling. He saw a man overweight but lean enough of face, standing 6'6", built like a bear, a strong nose, some teeth missing, a strong chin, and rather wild light blue eyes. He was an uncommon sort of bum. Deliberately he looked at his image out of the corners of his eyes, as was his way, because he was nonviolent, and eye contact might mean trouble. "You look like a Viking, Frank," old Father O'Malley had said him once. "But you ought to have been a monk." "Oh, Father," he had answered, "I'm too much of a fool for a monk." "Well," said Father O'Malley, "you're no more fool than many a brother, and you're celibate and continent, I take it. Yet it's late for that now. Look out, you darn turn berserker, Frank. Go to confession sometime, to a priest that doesn't know you, if you'll not go to me. If you'd confess, you'd not be haunted." But he seldom went to Mass, and never to confession. All those church boxes pilfered, his mother and father abandoned, his sister neglected, all the ghastly humbling of himself before policemen, all the horror and shame of the prisons. There could be no grace for him now. "There's a long, long trail of winding into the land of my dreams." What dreams? He had looked up Berserker and Webster. But he wouldn't ever do that sort of thing. A man had to keep a control upon himself, besides. He was a coward, and he loved peace. Nearly all the other prisoners had been brutes, guilty as sin, guilty as Miranda or Escobedo. One sentence for rifling a church safe, he had been put into the same cell with a man who had murdered his wife by taking off her head. The head never had been found. Sarsfield had dreamed of that head in such short intervals of sleep as he had enjoyed while the wife killer was his cellmate. Nearly all night, every night, he had lain awake, watching the murderer in the opposite bunk and feeling his own neck now and again. He had been surprised and pleased when eventually the wife killer had gone hysterical and obtained assignment to another cell. The murderer had told the church guards that he just couldn't stand being watched all night by that terrible giant who never talked. Only one of the prison psychiatrists had been pleasant or bright, and that had been the old doctor born in Vienna, who went round from penitentiary to penitentiary, checking on the psychiatric staff. The old doctor had taken a liking to him, and had written a report to accompany Frank's petition for parole. 3 months later, in a parole office, the parole officer had gone out hurriedly for a quarter of an hour, and Sarsfield had taken the chance to read his own file that the parole man had left in a folder on his desk. Frank Sarsfield has a memory that almost can be described as photographic, so had run one line in the Vienna doctor's report. When he read that, Sarsfield had known that the doctor was clever. He suffers chiefly from an arrest of emotional development and may be regarded as a rather bright, small boy in some respects. His 3 temporarily successful escapes from prison suggest that his intelligence has been much underrated. On at least one of these occasions, he could have eluded the arresting officer had he been willing to resort to violence. Sarsfield repeatedly describes himself as nonviolent and has no record of aggression while confined, not in connection with any of the offenses for which he was arrested. On the contrary, he seems timid and withdrawn, and might become a victim of assaults in prison, were it not for his size, strength, and power of voice. Sarsfield had been pleased enough by that paragraph, but a little puzzled by what followed. In general, Sarsfield is one of those recidivists who ought not to be confined where any alternative method now available for restraining them from petty offenses against property. Not only does he lack belligerence against men, but apparently he is quite clean of any record against women and children. It seems that he does not indulge in autoeroticism, either perhaps because of strict instruction by his mother during his formative years. I add, however, that conceivably Sarsfield is not fundamentally so gentle as his record indicates. He can be energetic in self-defense when pushed to the wall. In his youth, occasionally he was induced for the promise of $5 or $10 to stand up as an amateur against some traveling professional boxer. He admits that he did not fight hard and cried when he was badly beaten. Nevertheless, I am inclined to suspect a potentiality for violence, long repressed but not totally extinguished, by years of humbling himself, in his phrase. This possibility is not so certain as to warrant additional detention, even though 3 years of Sarsfield's sentence remain unexpired. Yes, he had memorized nearly the whole of that old doctor's analysis, which had got his parole for him. There had been the concluding paragraph. Francis Sarsfield is oppressed by a haunting sense of personal guilt. He is religious to the point of superstition and appears to believe himself damned. Although worldly wise in a number of respects, he retains an almost unique innocence in others. His frequent humor and candor account for his success, much of the time at begging. He has read much during his wanderings in terms of confinement. He has a strong taste for good poetry of the popular sort, and has accumulated a mass of miscellaneous information, much of it irrelevant to the life he leads. Although occasionally moody and even surly, most of the time he subjects himself to authority and will work fairly well if closely supervised. He possesses no skill of any sort unless some knack for wood chopping acquired while he was enrolled in the Civilian Conservation Corps can be considered a remarkable skill. He appears to be incorrigibly footloose, and therefore confinement is most unpleasant to him than to most prisoners. It is truly remarkable that he continues to be rational enough, his isolation and heavy guilt complex considered. Sometimes evasive when he does not desire to answer questions, nevertheless, he rarely utters a direct lie. His personal modesty may be described as excessive. His habits of cleanliness are commendable, if perhaps of origins like Lady Macbeth's. Despite his strength, he is a diabetic and suffers from a heart murmur, sometimes painful. Only in circumstances so favorable as to be virtually unobtainable could Sarsfield succeed in abstaining from the behavior patterns that has led to his repeated prosecution and imprisonment. The excessive crowding of this penitentiary considered, however, I strongly recommend that he be released upon parole. Previous psychiatric reports concerning this inmate have been shallow and erroneous, I regret to note. Perhaps Sarsfield's chief psychological difficulty is that, from obscure causes, he lacks emotional communication with other adults, although able to maintain cordial and healthy relations with small children. He is very nearly a solipsist, which in large part may account for his inability to make firm decisions or pursue any regular occupation. In contradiction of previous analysis of Sarsfield, he should not be described as dull, normal, intellectual. Francis Xavier Sarsfield distinctly is neither dull nor normal. Sarsfield had looked up solipsist, but hadn't found himself much the wiser. He didn't think himself the only existent thing, not most of the time anyway. He wasn't sure that the old doctor had been real, but he knew that his mother had been real before she went straight to heaven. He knew that his nightmares probably weren't real, but sometimes, while awake, he could see things that other men couldn't. In a house like this, he could glimpse little unaccountable movements out of the corners of his eyes, but it wouldn't do to worry about those. He was afraid of those things which other people couldn't see, yet not so frightened of them as most people were. Some of the other inmates had called him Crazy Frank, and it had been hard to keep down his temper. If you could perceive more existent things, though not flesh and blood things, than psychiatrists or convicts could, why were you then a solipsist? There was no point in puzzling over it. Dad had taken him out of school to work on the farm when he hadn't yet finished the fourth grade, so words like solipsist didn't mean much to him. Poet's words, though, he mostly understood. He had picked up a rhyme that made children laugh when he told it to them. Though you don't know it, you're a poet. Your feet show it, they're Longfellow's. That wasn't very good poetry, but Henry Wadsworth Longfellow was a good poet. They must have loved Henry Wadsworth Longfellow in this house, and especially the children's hour, because of those three little girls named Alice, Allegra, and Edith, and those lines on the general's boulder. Allegra, that's the prettiest of all names ever. And it means Mary, someone had told him. He looked at the cheap wristwatch he had bought, besides his wash-and-wear suit, with his last dishwashing money from that Lake Superior summer hotel. Well, midnight. It's up the wooden hill for you, Frank Sarsfield, to your snug little room under the rafters. If anybody comes to Tamarack House tonight, it's out the skylight and through the snow for you, Frank, my boy, and no tiny reindeer. If you want to survive in prison or out of it, you stick to your own business and let other folks do in their own juice. Before he closed his eyes, he would pray for Mother's soul. Not that she really needed it, and then say the little Scottish prayer he had found in children's book. From ghoulies and ghosties and long-leggedy beasties and things that go bump in the night, good Lord, deliver us. The next morning, the morning before his birthday, Frank Sarsfield went up the circular stair to the cupola, even before making his breakfast of pickled trout, peaches, and strong coffee. The wind had gone down and it was snowing only lightly now, but the drifts were immense. Nobody would make his way to Anthonyville and Tamarack House that day. The snowplows would be busy elsewhere. From this height, he could see the freeway, and nothing seemed to be moving along it. The dead village lay to the north of him. To the east were river and swamp, the shores lined with those handsome tamaracks, the green gone out of them, which had given this house its name. Everything in sight belonged to Frank. He had dreamed during the night, the wind howling and whining around the top of the house, and he had known he was dreaming, but it had been even stranger than usual, if less horrible. In his dream, he had found himself in the dining room of Tamarack House. He had not been alone. The general and father and mama and the three little girls had been dining happily at the long table, and he had waited on them. In the kitchen, an old woman, who was the cook, and a girl who cleaned, had eaten by themselves. But when he had finished filling the family's plates, he had sat down at the end of the table as if he had been expected to do that. The family had walked and talked amongst themselves and even to him as he ate, but somehow he had not been able to hear what they said to him. Suddenly, though, he had pricked up his ears because Allegra had spoken to him. "Frank," she had said, all mischief, "why do they call you Pumpkinhead?" The old general had frowned at the head of the table, and Mama had said, "Allegra, don't speak that way to Frank." But he had grinned at Allegra, if a little hurt, and had told the girl, Because some men think I've got a head like a jack-o'-lantern, and that's not even seeds in it. Nonsense, Frank, Mama had put in. You have a very handsome head. You've got a pretty head, Frank, the three little girls had told him, almost in chorus, placatingly. Allegra had come around the table to make her peace. There's going to be a big surprise for you tomorrow, Frank, she had whispered to him, and then she had kissed him on the cheek. That had waked him. Most of the rest of that howling night, he had lain awake trying to make sense of his dream. But he couldn't. The people in it had been more real than the people he met on the long, long trail. Now he strolled through the house again, admiring everything. It was almost as if he had seen the furniture and the pictures and the carpets long, long ago. The house must be over a century old, and many of the good things in it must go back to the beginning. He would have two or three more days here until the roads were cleared. There were no newspapers to tell him about the great storm, of course, and no radio that worked, but that didn't matter. He found a great big handsome complete works of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow in red morocco and an illustrated copy of the Rubaiyat. He didn't need to read it because he had memorized all the quatrains at once. There was a black silk ribbon as marker between the pages, and he opened it there at quatrain 44, it turned out. Why, if the soul can fling the dust aside and naked on the air of heaven ride, we're not ashamed for him in this clay carcass crippled to abide. That old Vienna doctor, Frank suspected, hadn't believed in immortal souls. Frank Sarsfield knew better, but also Frank suspected that his soul never would ride, naked or clothed, on the air of heaven souls. That put him in mind of his sister, a living soul that he had forsaken. He ought to write her a letter on this eve of his 60th birthday. Frank traveled light, his luggage being mostly a safety razor, a hairbrush, and a comb. He washed his shirt and socks and underclothes every night, and off his wash and wear suit too. But he did carry with him a few sheets of paper and a ballpoint pen. Sitting down at the library table, he had built a fire in the library stove also. There being no lack of logs, he began to write to Mary Sarsfield alone in the roaring farmhouse in New Hampshire. His spelling wasn't good, he knew, but today he was careful at his birthday letter, using the big old dictionary with a general's bookplate in it. To write that letter took most of the day. Two versions were discarded. At last, Frank had done the best he could. Dearest Mary, my sister, it's been nearly 9 years since I came to visit you and borrowed the $78 from you and went away again and never paid it back. I guess you don't want to see your brother, Frank, again after what I did that time and other times. But the Ethiopian cannot change his skin, nor the leopard his spots. And when some man like a Jehovah's Witness or that rancher with all the cash gives me quite a lot of money, I mean to send to you what I owe. But the post office isn't handy at the time, so I spend it on presents for little kids. I meet and buy new clothes and such as I never get round to sending you that $78, Mary. Right now I have $29 and more, but the post office at this place is folded up. By the time I get to the next town, the money will be mostly gone, and so it goes. I guess probably you need the money, and I'm sorry, Mary, but maybe someday I will win in the lottery, and then I'll give you all the thousands of dollars I win. Well, Mary, it's been 41 years and 183 days since Mother passed away, and here I am 60 years old tomorrow, and you getting on toward 56. I pray that your cough is better and that your son and my nephew Jack is doing better than he was in Tallahassee, Florida. Sometime, Mary, if you would write to me, care of Father Justin O'Malley in Albatross, Michigan. When he is pastor now, I would stop by his rectory and get your letter and read it with joy. But I know I've been a very bad brother, and I don't blame you, Mary, if you never get around to writing your brother Frank. Mary, I've been staying out of jails and working a little here and there along the road. Now, Mary, do you know what I hate most about those prisons? Why, not being on the road, you will say. No, Mary, the worst thing is the foul language the convicts use from morning till night, taking the name of their Lord in vain, and the least they do. There's a foul curse word in their every sentence. I wasn't brought up that way any more than you, Mary, and I will not revile woman or child. It is like hearing an H to hear it. I'm not in bad shape either, except the diabetes is no better, but I take my pills for it when I can buy them, and don't have to take needles for it. My heart hurts me dreadfully bad sometimes when I lift heavy things hours on end, and sometimes it hurts me worse at night when I've been just lying there thinking of the life I've led and how I ought to pay you the $78 and pay back other folks that helped me out too. I owe Father O'Malley $497.11 now altogether, and I keep track of it in my head, and when the lottery ticket wins, he will not be forgot. Some people have been quite good to me, and I still can make them laugh, and I recite to them, and generally I start my reciting with what no person of quality wrote hundreds of years ago. Seven wealthy towns contend for Homer dead, though which the living Homer begged his bread. They like that, and also usually they like Thomas Gray elegy at a country churchyard, leaving the world to darkness and to me, and I recite all of that, and sometimes some of the quatrains of Omar. As farms, when they ask me, I chop wood for these folks, and I help with the dishes, but I still break a good many, as you learned, Mary, 9 years ago. But I didn't mean to do it, Mary, because I am just clumsy in all ways. Oh, yes, I am good at reciting Frost stopping by woods in his poem about the hired man. I have been reading the poetical works of Thomas Deems Eliot, so I can recite his The Hollow Man, or much of it, and also his book of Practical Cats, which is comical when I come to college towns. Some professor or his wife gives me a sandwich and maybe $2 and maybe a ride to the next town. When I am now married, I ought to study the poems of John Greenleaf Whittier, because there's been a real blizzard, maybe the biggest in the state for many years, and I'm snowbound. Years ago I tried to memorize all that poem, but I got only part way, for it is a whopper of a poem. I don't hear much good music, Mary, because, of course, at the motels there isn't any phonograph or tape recorder. I'd like to hear some good string quartet, or maybe old folk songs, well sung for music, hath charms to soothe the savage beast. There's an old Edison at the house where I'm staying now, and what do you know, they have a record of a song you and I used to sing together. There's a long, long trail of winding. It's about the newest record in this house. I'll play it again soon, thinking of you, Mary, my sister. Oh, there is a long, long night of waiting. Mary, right now I'm at a big, fine house where the people have gone away for a while, and I watch the house for them and keep some of the rooms warm. Let me assure you, Mary, I won't take anything from this good old house when I go. These are nice people, I know, and I just come in and out of the storm, and I'm very fond of their three sweet little girls. I remember what you looked like when I ran away first, and you look like one of them called Alice. The one I like best, though, is Allegra, because she makes mischief and laughs a lot, but is innocent. I came here just yesterday, but it seems as if I had lived in this house before, but of course I couldn't have, and I feel at home here. Nothing in this house could scare me much. You might not like it, Mary, because of little noises and glimpses you get, but it's a lovely house, and as you know, I like old places that have been lived in lots. By the way, Mary, once upon a time, Father O'Malley told me that to the Lord all time is eternally present. I think this means everything that happens in the world in any day goes on all at once. So God sees what went on in this house long ago and what's going on in this house today all at the same time. It's just as well we don't see through God's eyes, because then we'd know everything that's going to happen to us. And because I'm such a sinner, I don't want to know. Father O'Malley says that God may forgive me everything and have something special in store for me, but I don't think so, because why should he? And Father O'Malley says that maybe some people work out their purgatory here on earth, and I might be one of these. He says we are spirits in the prison house of the body, which is like we were serving time in the world here below, and maybe God forgave me long ago, and I'm just waiting my time and paying for what I did, and it will be all right in the end. Or maybe I'm being given some second chance to set things right, but as Father O'Malley put it, to do, I'd have to fortify my will and do some signal act of contrition. Father O'Malley even says I might not have to do the act actually, if only I just made up my mind to do it really and truly, because what God counts is the intention. But I think people who are in purgatory must know they're climbing up and have hope. And Mary, I think I'm going down, 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 even though I've stayed out of prison some time now. Father O'Malley tells me that for everybody, the battle is soon or lost already in God's eyes, and that though Satan thinks he has a good chance to conquer, actually Satan has lost forever, but doesn't know it. Mary, I never did anybody any good, but only harm to ones that loved me. If just once before I die, I could do one signal act that was truly good, then God might love me and let me have the beatific vision. Yet, Mary, I know I'm weak of will and a coward and lazy, and I've missed my chance forever. Well, Mary, my only sister, I've bored you long enough, and I just wanted to say hello and tell you to be of good cheer. I'm sorry I whined and complained like a little boy about my health, because I'm still strong and deserve all the pain I get. Mary, if you can forgive your big brother, who never grew up, please pray for me sometime, because nobody else does except possibly Father O'Malley when he isn't busy with other prayers. I pray for Mother every night and every other night for you, and once a month for Dad. You were a good little girl and sweet. Now I will say goodbye and ask your pardon for bothering you with my foolishness. Also, I'm sorry your friend found out I was just a hobo when I was with you 9 years ago. And I don't blame you for being angry with me then for talking too much. And I know I wasn't fit to lodge in your house. There aren't many of us old real hobos left, only beatniks and such that can't walk or chop wood. And I guess that is just as well. It is a degrading life, Mary, but I can't stop walking down that long, long trail, not knowing when it ends. Your loving brother, Frank. P.S. I don't wish to mislead you, so I will add, Mary, that the people who own this house didn't exactly ask me in, but it's all right, because I won't do any harm here, but a little good if I can. Good night again, Mary. Now, he needed an envelope, but he had forgotten to take one from the last motel where the Presbyterian minister had put him up. There must be some in Tamarack House, and one would not be missed. And that would not be very wrong, because he would take nothing else. He found no envelopes in the drawers of the library table, so he went up the stairs and almost knocked at the closed door of Allegra's room. Foolish. He opened the door gently. He had admired Allegra's small rosewood desk. In its drawer was a leather letter folder, the kind with a blotter. He found, and in the folder were several yellowed envelopes. Although lying face up in the folder was a letter of several small pages, in a woman's hand, a trifle shaky. He started to sit down to read Allegra's letter that never was sent to anybody, but it passed through his mind that his great body might break the delicate rosewood chair that belonged to Allegra. So he read the letter standing. It was dated January 14, 1969. On that birthday of his, he had been in Joliet prison. How beautifully Allegra wrote. Dear Celia, this is a lovely day at Tamarack House. Just 54 years after your great-grandfather, the general, died, so I am writing to my grandniece to tell you how much I hope you will be able to come up to Anthonyville and stay with me next summer, if I still am here. The doctor says that only God knows whether I will be. Your grandmother wants me to come down your way to stay with her for the rest of this winter, but I can't bear to leave Tamarack House at my age, for they might have to put me in a rest home down there, and then I wouldn't see this old house again. I am all right, really, because kind Mr. Connor looks in every day, and Mrs. Williams comes every other day to clean. I am not sick, my little girl, but simply older than my years, and running down. When you come up next summer, God willing, I will make you that soft toast you like, and perhaps Mr. Connell will turn the crank for the ice cream, and I may try to make some preserves with you to help me. You weren't lonely, were you, when you stayed with me last summer for a whole month? Of course, there are fewer than 100 people left in Anthonyville now, and most of those are old. They say that there will be practically nobody living in the town a few years from now, when the new highway is completed and the old one is abandoned. There were more than 2,000 people here in town and roundabout a few years after the general built Tamarack House. But first the lumber industry gave out, and then the mines were exhausted, and the prison break in 1915 scared many away forever. There are no passenger trains now, and they say the railway line will be pulled out altogether when the new freeway have just begun building it to the east is ready for traffic. But we still have the maples and the tamaracks, and there are ever so many raccoons and opossums and squirrels for you to watch, and a lynx, I think, and an otter or two, and many deer. Celia, last summer you asked me about the general's death and all the things that happened then, because you had heard something of them from your grandmother Edith. But I didn't wish to frighten you, so I didn't tell you everything. You are older now, and you have a right to know, because when you grow up, you will be one of the trustees of the Anthony Family Trust, and then this old house will be in your charge when I'm gone. Tamarack House is not at all frightening, except a little in the morning on every January 14. I do hope that you and the other trustees will keep the house always with the money that Father left to me. He was good at making money, even though the forest vanished and the miners failed, by his investments in Chicago, and which I'm leaving to the family trust. I've kept the house just as it was for the sake of the general's memory, and because I love it that way. You asked just what happened on January 14, 1915. There were several people who slept in the house that month, not counting Cook and Cynthia, who was a kind of nanny to us girls and also clean, because they slept at their houses in the village. In the house, of course, was a general, my grandfather, your great-grandfather, who was nearly 80 years old. Then there was Father and Mama, and the three of us little sisters, and dear Frank. Alice, and sometimes even that baby Edith, used to tease me in those days by screaming, Frank's Allegra sweetheart, Frank's Allegra sweetheart. I used to chase him, but I suppose it was true he liked me best. Of course, he was about 60 years old, though not so old as I am now. And I was a little thing. He used to take me through the swamps and show me the muskrat's house. The first time he took me on such a trip, Mama raised her eyebrows when he was out of the room, but the general said, "I'll warn Frank. I have his papers." Alice and Edith might just as well have shouted, "Frank's Allegra's slave." He read to me, Robert Louis Stevenson's poems and all sorts of books. I never had another sweetheart, partly because almost all the young men left Anthonyville as I grew up, when there was no work for them here, and the ones that remained didn't please Mama. We three sisters used to play creep mouse with Frank. I remember well. We would be the creep mice and would sneak up and scare him when he wasn't watching, and he would pretend to be terrified. He made up a little song for us, or rather he put words to some tune he had borrowed. "Down, down, down in creep mouse town, all the lamps are low, and the little rotten feet softly come and go. There's a rat in creep mouse town, and a bat or two. Everything in creep mouse town would swiftly frighten you." Do you remember, Celia, that the general was state supervisor of prisons and reformatories for time out of mind? He was a good architect, too, and designed Anthonyville State Prison without taking any fee for himself as a model prison. Some people in the Capitol said that he did it to give employment to his country, but really it was because the site was so isolated that it would be difficult for convicts to escape. The general knew Frank's last name, but never told the rest of us. Frank had been in Anthonyville State Prison at one time, and later in other prisons, and the general had taken him out of one of those other prisons on parole, having known Frank when he was locked up at Anthonyville. I never learned what Frank had done to be sentenced to prison, but he was gentle with me and everybody else until that early morning of January 14. The general was amused by Frank and said that Frank would be better off with us than anywhere else. So Frank became our hired man and chopped the firewood for us and kept the fires going in the stoves and fireplaces and sometimes served at dinner. In summer, he was supposed to scythe the lawns, but of course summer didn't come. Frank arrived by train at Anthonyville Station in October, and we gave him the little room at the top of the house. Well, on January 12th, Father went off to Chicago on business. We still had the general. Every night he barred the shutters on the ground floor, going round to all the rooms by himself. Mama knew he did it because there was a rumor that some life convicts at the prison had it in for the supervisor of prisons, although the general had retired 5 years earlier. Also, they may have thought he kept a lot of money in the house, when actually, what with the timber gone and the mines gone, in those times we were rather hard-pressed and certainly kept our money in the bank at Duluth. But we girls didn't know why the general closed the shutters, except that it was one of the general's rituals. Besides, Anthonyville State Prison was supposed to be escape-proof. It was just that the general always took precautions, though ever so brave. Just before dawn, Celia, on the cold morning of January 14, 1915, we all were waked by the siren of the prison, and we all rushed downstairs in our nightclothes, and we could see that the part of the prison was afire. Oh, the sky was red. The general tried to telephone the prison, but he couldn't get through, and later it turned out that the lines had been cut. Next, it all happened so swiftly. We heard shouting somewhere down Main Street, and then guns went off. The general knew what that meant. He had got his trousers and his boots on, and now he struggled with his old military overcoat, and he took his old army revolver. "Lock the door behind me, girl," he told Mama. She cried and tried to pull him back inside, but he went down into the snow, nearly 80 though he was. Only 3 or 4 minutes later, we heard the shots. The general had met the convicts at the gate. It was still dark, and the general had cataracts in his eyes. They say he fired first and missed. Those bad men had broken into Mr. Emmons' store and taken guns and axes and whiskey. They shot the general, shot him again and again and again. The next thing we knew, they were chopping at our front door with axes. Mama hugged us. "Celia, dear, writing all this has made me so silly. I feel a little odd. So I must go lie down for an hour or two before telling you the rest. Celia, I do hope you will love this old house as much as I have. If I'm not here when you come up, remember that where I have gone, I will know the general and father and Mama and Alice and poor dear Frank, and will be ever so happy with them. Be a good little girl, my Celia." The letter ended there, unsigned. Frank clumped downstairs to the Sunday parlor. He was crying for the first time since he had fought that professional heavyweight on October 19, 1943. Allegra's letter, if only she'd finished it. What had happened to those little girls? And Mama? And that other Frank? He thought of something from the Holy Bible. It were better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck, and he cast into the sea, than that he should offend one of these little ones. Already it was almost evening. He lit the wick in the cranberry glass lamp that hung from the middle of the parlor ceiling, standing on a chair to reach it. Why not enjoy more light? On a whim, he arranged upon the round table 4 silver candlesticks that had rested above the fireplace. He needed 3 more, and those he fetched from the dining room. He lit every candle in the circle, 1 for the general, 1 for father, 1 for Mama, 1 for Alice, 1 for Allegra, 1 for Edith, and 1 for Frank. The dear names of those little girls he might as well recite aloud, it being good practice for the approaching days on the long, long trail. I hear in the chamber above me the patter of little feet, the sound of a door that is opened, and voices soft and sweet. Here he ceased. Had he heard something in the passage, or descending the broad hall stair? Because of the wind outside, he could not be certain. It cost him a gritting of his teeth to rise and open the parlor door. Of course, no one could be seen in the hall or on the stair. Crazy Frank, men had called him at Joliet and other prisons. He had clenched his fist, but he had kept a check upon himself. Didn't St. Paul say that the violent take heaven by storm? Perhaps he had barked up the wrong tree. Perhaps he would be spewed out of his mouth for being too peaceful. Shutting the door, he went back to the fireside. Those lines of Longfellow's had been no invocation. He put the long, long trail on the old phonograph again, strolling about the room until the record ran out. There was an old print of a Great Lakes schooner on one wall that he liked. Beside it, he noticed there seemed to be some pellets embedded in a closet door jamb, but painted over as if someone had fired a shotgun in the parlor in the old days. The violent take it by storm. He admired the grand piano. Perhaps Allegra had learned to play it. There were 1 or 2 big notches or gashes along one edge of the piano, varnished over hard enough that wood was. Then Frank sank into the big chair again and stared at the burning logs. Just how long he had dozed, he did not know. He woke abruptly. Had he heard a whisper, the faintest whisper? He tensed to spring up, but before he could move, he saw reflections in the tall mirror. Something had moved in the corner by the bookcase. No doubt about it, that small something had stirred again. Also, something crept behind one of the satin sofas, and something else lurked near the piano. All these were at his back. He saw the reflections in the glass, as in a glass darkly, more alarming than physical forms. In this high shadowy room, the light of the kerosene lamp and of the 7 candles did not suffice. From near the bookcase, the first of them emerged into candlelight. Then came the second and the third. They were giggling, but he could not hear them, only see their faces, and those not clearly. He was unable to stir, and the goose flesh prickled all over him, and his hair rose at the back of his big head. They were 3 little girls, barefoot, in their long muslin nightgowns, ready for bed. One may have been as much as 12 years old, and the smallest was little more than a baby. The middle one was Allegra, tiny even for her 10 years, and a little imp. He knew. They were playing creep mouse. The 3 of them stole forward, Allegra in the lead, her eyes alight. He could see them play now, and the dread was ebbing out of him. He might have risen and returned to greet them across the great gulf of time, but any action, why, what might it do to these little ones? Frank sat frozen in his chair, looking at the nimble reflections in the mirror, and nearer they came, perfectly silent. Allegra vanished from the glass, which meant that she must be standing just behind him. He must please them. Could he speak? He tried, and the lines came out hoarsely. Down, down, down in Creep Mouse Town, all the lamps are low, and the little rodent feet. He was not permitted to finish. Wow! There came a light tug at the curly white hair on the back of his head. Oh, to talk with Allegra, the imp! Recklessly he heaved his bulk out of the chair and swung round too late. The parlor door was closing. But from the hall came another whisper, ever so faint, ever so unmistakable. Good night, Frank. There followed subdued giggles, scampering, and then the silence once more. He strode to the parlor door. The hall was empty again, and the broad stair. Should he follow them up? No. All 3 would be abed now. Should he knock at Mama's room, muttering, Mrs. Anthony, are the children all right? No, he hadn't the nerve for that, and it would be presumptuous. He had been given 1 moment of perception, and no more. Somehow he knew that they would not go so far as the garret floor. Oh, he needed fresh air. He snuffed out lamp and candles except for 1 candlestick, Allegra's. That he took with him. Out into the hall he went. He unfastened the front door with that oaken patch about the middle of it, and stepped upon the porch, leaving the burning candle just within the hall. The wind had risen again, bringing still more snow. It was black as sin outside, and the temperature must be 30 below. To him the wind bore 1 erratic peal of the desolate church bell of Anthonyville, and then another. How strong the blast must be through the belfry! Frank retreated inside from that unfathomable darkness and that sepulchral bell, which seemed to toll for him. He locked the thick door behind him and screwed up his courage for the expedition to his room at the top of the old house. But why shudder? He loved them now, Allegra most of all. Up the broad stairs to the 2nd floor he went, hearing only his own clumsy footfalls, and past the clay-sealed doors of the General and Father and Mama and Alice and Allegra and Edith. No one whispered, no one scampered. In Frank's room he rolled himself in his blanket and quilt. Had Allegra helped stitch the patchwork? And almost at once the consciousness went out of him, and he must have slept dreamless for the first night since he was a farm boy. So profound had been his sleep, deep almost as death, that the siren may have been wailing for some minutes before at last it roused him. Frank knew the horrid sound. It had called for him thrice before as he fled from prisons. Who wanted him now? He heaved his ponderous body out of the warm bed. The candle that he had brought up from the Sunday parlor and left burning all night was flickering in its socket, but by that flame he could see that the hour on his watch, 7 o'clock. Too soon for dawn. Through the narrow skylight as he flung on his clothes, the sky glowed an unnatural red, though it was long before sunup. The prison siren ceased to wail, as if choked off. Frank lumbered to the little frieze window and saw to the north, perhaps 2 miles distant, a monstrous mass of flames shooting high into the air. The prison was afire. Then came shots outside. First the bark of a heavy revolver, followed irregularly by blasts of shotguns or rifles. Frank was lacing his boots with a swiftness uncongenial to him. He got into his overcoat as there came a crashing and battering downstairs. That sound, too, he recognized. Woodchopper that he had been, axes shattering the front door. Amid this pandemonium, Frank was too bewildered to grasp altogether where he was, or even how this catastrophe might be fitted into the pattern of time. All that mattered was flight. The scheme of his escape remained clear in his mind. Pull up the chair below the skylight. Heave yourself out to the upper floor. Descend those iron rungs to the woodshed roof. Make for the other side of the highway. Then why? Then you must trust to circumstance, Frank. It's that long, long trail of winding for you. Now he heard a woman screaming within the house and slipped and fumbled in his alarm. He had got up the chair, opened the skylight, and was trying to obtain a good grip on the icy outer edge of the skylight frame when someone knocked and kicked at the door of Frank's room. Yet those were puny knocks and kicks. He was about to leave when he, in a relative quiet, the screaming had ceased for a moment. He heard a little shrill voice outside his door, urgently pleading, "Frank, Frank, let me in!" He was arrested in flight as though great weights had been clamped to his ankles. That little voice he knew as if it were part of him, Allegra's voice. For a brief moment he still meant to scramble out the skylight, but the sweet little voice was begging. He stumbled off the chair, upset it, and was at the door in one stride. "Is that you, Allegra? Open it, Frank, please open it." He turned the key and pulled the bolt. On the threshold the little girl stood, indistinct by the dying candlelight, terribly pale, all tears, frantic. Frank snatched her up. Ah, this was the dear, real Allegra Anthony, all warm and soft and sobbing. Flesh and blood, he kissed her cheek gently. She clung to him in terror and then squirmed loose, tagging at his heavy hand. "Oh, Frank, come down, come downstairs. They're hurting Mama." "Who is little girl?" he said, holding her tiny hands, his body quivering with dread and indecision. "Who's down there, Allegra?" "The bad men. Come on, Frank." Braver than he, the little thing plunged back down the garret stair into the blackness below. "Allegra, come back here. Come back now," he bellowed, but she was gone. Up 2 flights of stairs there poured to him a tumult of shrieks, curses, laughter, breaking noises. Several men were below, their speech slurred and raucous. He did not need Allegra to tell him what kind of men they were, for he heard prison slang and prison foulness, and he shook all over. There still was the skylight. He would have turned back to that hole in the roof had not Allegra squealed in pain somewhere on the second floor. Dazed, trembling, unarmed, Frank went down 3 steps into the garret staircase. "Allegra, little girl! What is it, Allegra?" Someone was charging up the stair toward him. It was a burly man in the prison uniform, a lighted lantern in one hand and a glittering axe in the other. Frank had no time to turn. The man screeched obscenely at him and swung the axe. In those close quarters, wielded by a drunken man, it was a chancy weapon. The edge shattered the plaster wall. The flat of the blade thumped upon Frank's shoulder. Frank, lurching forward, took the man by the throat with a mighty grip. They all tumbled pell-mell down the steep stairs, the 2 men, the axe, the lantern. Frank's ursine bulk landed atop the stranger's body, and Frank heard his adversary's bones crunch. The lantern had broken and gone out. The convict's head hung loose on his shoulder. Frank found as he groped for the axe. Then he trampled over the fallen man and flung himself along the corridor, gripping the axe helve. "Allegra! Allegra, girl!" From the head of the main stairs he could see that the lamps and candles were burning in the hall and in the rooms of the ground floor. All three children were down there, wailing, and above their noise rose Mama's shrieks again. A mob of men were stamping, breaking things, roaring with amusement and desire, shouting filth, a bottle shattered. His heart pounding as if it would burst out of his chest, Frank hurried rashly down the stairs and went, all crimson with fury, into the Sunday parlor, the double-bitted axe swinging in his hand. They all were there, the little girls, Mama, and five wild men. "Stop that!" Frank roared with all the power of his lungs. "You let them go!" Everyone in the parlor stood transfixed at the summons like the last trumpet. Allegra had been tugging pathetically at the leg of a dark man who gripped her mother's waist, and the other girls sputtered and sobbed, cornered as tall man poured a bottle of whiskey over them. Mrs. Anthony's gown was ripped nearly its whole length, and a third man was bending her backwards by her long hair as if he would snap her spine. Near the hall door stood a man like a long, lean rat, the rat of Crete Mouse Town, a shotgun in his arm, gape-jawed at Frank's intervention. Guns and axes lay scattered about the turkey carpet. By the fireplace, a fifth man had been heating the poker in the flames. For that tableau moment, they all stared astonished at the raving giant who had burst upon them, and the giant, puffing, stared back with his strange blue eyes. "Oh, Frank," Allegra sobbed. It was more command than entreaty, as if Frank thought in a flash of insane mirth he were like the boy in the fairy tale, who could cry confidently, "All heads off but mine." He knew what these men were, the rats and bats of Crete Mouse Town, the worst men in any prison, lifers who had made their hell upon earth, killers all of them, and worse than killers. The rotten damnation showed in all those flushed and drunken faces. Then the dark man let go of Mama and said in relief with a coughing laugh, "Hell, it's only old Pumpkinhead Frank clowning again. Have some fun for yourself, Frank boy." "Hey, Frank," Ratface asked, his shotgun crooked under his arm, "where'd the old man keep his money?" Frank towered there perplexed, the berserker lust draining out of him, almost bashful, and frightened worse than ever before in all his years on the trail. What should he shout now? What should he do? Who was he to resist such perfect evil? They were 5-1, and those five were fiends from down under, and that one a coward. Long ago he had been weighed in the balance and found wanting. Mama was the first to break the tableau. Her second captor had relaxed his clutch upon her hair. She prodded the little girls before her and leaped for the door. The hair puller was after her at once, but she bounded past Rat-Faced Shotgun, which had wavered toward Frank, and Alice and Edith were ahead of her. Allegra, her eyes wide and desperate, tripped over the rungs of a broken chair. Everything happened in half a second. The hair puller caught Allegra by her little ankle. Then Frank bellowed again, loudest in all his life, and he swung his axe high above his head and downward, a skillful, dreadful stroke catching the hair puller's arm just below the shoulder. At once the man began to scream and spout, while Allegra fled after her mother. Falling, the hair puller collided with Ratface, spoiling his aim, but one barrel of shotgun fired, and Frank felt pain in his side. His bloody axe on high, he hulked between the five men and the door. All the men's faces were glaring at Frank incredulously, as if demanding how he dared stir against them. Three convicts were scrabbling tippetly for weapons on the floor. As Frank strode among them, he saw the expression on those faces change from gloating to desperation. Just as a second blow descended, there passed through his mind a kind of fleshly collage of death he had seen once at a farmyard gate. The corpses of five weasels nailed to a gatepost by the farmer, their frozen open jaws agape like damned souls in hell. All heads off but mine, Frank heard himself braying. All heads off but mine. He hacked and hewed, his own screams of lunatic fury drowning the screams of terror. For less than 3 minutes, shots, thuds, shrieks, crashes, terrible wailing, they could not get past him to the doorway. Come on, Frank was raging as he stood in the middle of the parlor. Come on, who's next? All heads off but mine. Who's next? There came no answer but a ghastly rattle from one of the five heaps that littered the carpet. Blood soaked from hair to boots, the berserker towered alone, swaying where he stood. His mind began to clear. He had been shot twice, Frank guessed, and the pain at his heart was frightful. Into his frantic consciousness burst all the glory of what he had done, and all the horror. He became almost rational. He must count the dead. One upstairs, five here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 heaps. That was correct. All present and accounted for, Frank boy. Pumpkinhead Frank. Crazy Frank. All dead and accounted for. Had he thought that before? Had he taken that mackerel before? Had he wrought this slaughter twice over? Twice in this same old room? But where were Mama and the little girls? They mustn't see this blood-splashed inferno of a parlor. He was looking at himself in the tall mirror, and he saw a bare man loathsome with his own blood and others' blood. He looked like the wild man of Borneo. In abhorrence, he flung his axe aside. Behind him sprawled the reflections of the hacked dead. Fighting down his heart pain, he reeled into the hall. Little girls, Mrs. Anthony, Allegra, oh, Allegra, his voice was less strong. Where are you? It's safe now. They did not call back. He labored up the main stair, clutching his side. Allegra, speak to your Frank. They were in none of the bedrooms. He went up the garret stair. Whatever the agony, then beyond Frank's room to the cupola stair, and ascended that slowly, gasping hard. They were not in the cupola. Might they have run out among the trees? In that cold dawn, he stared on every side. He thought his sight was beginning to fail. He could see no one outside the house. The drifts still choked the street beyond the gateposts, and those two boulders protruded impassive from untrodden snow. Back down the flight of stairs, he made his way, clutching at the rail at the wall. Surely the little girls hadn't strayed into that parlor butcher shop. He bit his lip and peered into the Sunday parlor. The bodies all were gone. The splashes and ropey strands of blood all were gone. Everything stood in perfect order, as if violence never had touched Tamarack House. The sun was rising and sunlight filtered through the shutters. Within 15 minutes the trophies of his savage victory had disappeared. It was like the recurrent dream which had tormented Frank when he was little. He separated from mother in the dark, wandering solitary in empty lanes, no soul alive in all the universe but little Frank. Yet those tremendous axe blows had severed living flesh and blood, and for one moment there on the stairs he had held in his arms a tiny, quick Allegra of that reality he did not doubt at all. Wonder, subduing pain, he staggered to the front door. It stood unshattered. He drew the bar and turned the key and went down the stone steps into the snow. He was weak now and did not know where he was going. Had he done a signal attack? Might the Lord give him one parting glimpse of little Allegra somewhere among the trees? He slipped in a drift, half rose, sank again, crawled. He found himself at the foot of one of those boulders, the further one, the stone he had not inspected. The snow had fallen away from the face of the bronze tablet. Clutching the boulder, Frank drew himself up. By bringing his eyes very close to the tablet, he could read the words, a dying man panting against deathless bronze. In loving memory of Frank, a spirit in prison, made for eternity, who saved us and died for us. January 14, 1915. Why the soul can fling the dust aside, and naked on the air of heaven ride, were not a shame for him, in this clay carcass crippled to abide.